Hello and welcome to this week's Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fosbero. Politics is a volatile, unforgiving business, a revolving door for some, a lifelong career for others. And my guest today, even though he's never been an MP, has been at the centre of modern British political life for a long time, in journalism, broadcasting, and most famously inside Number 10 as Tony Blair's right-hand man and director of communications. Alistair Campbell survived the pressure cooker of a very public life, but has openly revealed another side of what many regarded as a feisty character, a more vulnerable aspect emerging in 8 volumes of memoirs and detailed in his book, Living Better, How I Learned to Survive Depression, about to be published in paperback. He's the only bagpipe-playing Burnley supporter we've had on the podcast, although you never know. Alistair, it has been many years since I was interviewing you regularly on Sky News and reporting on the Blair campaign trail. How the devil are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very well. It's great to have you on the podcast. Pleasure. And I gather congratulations are in order.
So I hear. Civil partnership. I had no idea that it would like be seen as a big thing.
It's seen as a big thing because you've been together more than 40 years, haven't you?
We have been together more than 40 years, but that's partly why I was surprised it was seen as a big thing and that people were sort of interested in it.
Are you sure you're not rushing things after 40-something years?
Well, I worked out the other day that we have to live to 93, both of us, to get to the same length as the Queen and the Duke.
Well, you scrubbed up nicely in your kilt. I mean, seriously, yeah. What made you finally go for it and do the civil partnership with Fiona?
Well, partly because we could, and Fiona was a big part of the campaign to get the same right to a civil partnership for heterosexual couples, as it has been for some time since we were in power, for gay couples. Because we did the gay couples legislation, David Cameron did gay marriage, and it meant that there was nothing for people like us. I'm an atheist. We're both atheists, and Fiona's a big feminist who doesn't want to do the whole obey, give away, all that stuff. And so it just seemed quite a nice thing to do. And I was quite pleased, because I'm quite antisocial in my own way. I was quite pleased it was a time when you could only have 4 guests. So we had our 3 children and 1 girlfriend, and that was it. And it was very nice, and we all came back here, and it was that really, really hot summer day in the middle of April when the rest of the time was completely freezing. So yeah, it was good.
You've described Fiona as your greatest stroke of luck. What a lovely way to describe her.
Well, it's true in a way. I do think if I didn't have Fiona in my life, I would probably fall apart. I mean, lots of different... Now, I don't know that because, you know, we can adapt and I'm quite adaptable in my own way. But no, lucky in so many ways. I mean, the fact that, you know, I say this in the book, the fact that she stood by me when I thought she wouldn't, when I had my breakdown in the 80s, the fact that she's quite good at dealing with my depression, a lot better than she used to be. And just she's so kind of organized and just organizes our lives together. And I absolutely hate the whole lockdown thing and COVID and what have you. But it's been quite nice to be sort of locked away together and find that it's been okay.
And of course, there was the added attraction when you met her. Didn't she drive comedian Peter Cook's car?
By then it was her car.
Yes. It sounded like it wasn't, but that's what I meant.
And it is really strange. As I say in the book, it's the only number plate in my history that I can remember, MMU 353L, and we were training together as trainee journalists down in Plymouth. I couldn't drive, I didn't have a license, and Fiona I think was the only trainee with her own car. It definitely made her more attractive.
But I'm wondering, Alistair, what she was attracted to, because in the book you've admitted that when you met her you've said you were a chain smoking, hard drinking, crap food eating, exercise free zone. What on earth did she see in you with her Peter Cook car?
Well, if you fast forward to the chapter that she's written, How to Live with Depression When It's Not Your Own, she sort of says why. I mean, she found me quite interesting and quite true. She said she'd never met anybody like me before, which I took as a compliment, but I think subsequently learned that what she meant is she'd never met anybody from the north who wore, as she said, wore a sports jacket. Helen, I used to smoke in bed. That's so disgusting. I've got a very strong memory, even though I was absolutely smashed out of my brain. I've got a memory of her carrying me or dragging me up the stairs when I was like comatose after a bender on scotch. I don't know if I'd have done the same if it had been the other way around. I don't know.
The honesty is what I really like about your writing, and that you talk about in surviving decades of depression that you and Fiona have had many ups and downs. But one of the big ones was she really, really didn't want you to work for Tony Blair, did she? Tell us a bit about that.
No, she didn't. And I think it was partly because we'd sort of got our lives back on track after the breakdown, a year after the breakdown. The breakdown was 86. 1987, Rory, our first son, was born. Callum 2 years later, and then Grace a few years after that. And Fiona's dad had just died. Grace had just been born. Tony Blair asked me to go and work for him. And she really, really didn't want me to, nor did my mum, nor did my dad, nor did a lot of people. But I sort of felt I had to, really. Yeah, there definitely were times thereafter when I think a lot of women just said, I'm just not putting up with this.
Do you think she was worried about the pressure of it, 18-hour days ahead and the stress of it all, and was just worried about family life and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, she was worried about that from her perspective and the family's perspective and from my perspective as well. Yeah, I still see that now when I get, you know, I lead a very different sort of life now, but I still have a tendency, if something comes along that I'm really interested in, that I just go for it. And she worries about that, that I can still do that. And that's why, you know, there are very few things that I do, decisions that I make now, that I don't really, I think it drives her a bit crazy, actually. It can be quite a small thing. Should I do that speech next week that I've just been asked to do in, I mean, not in lockdown, but, you know, it used to be like things like, oh, they want me to go to Athens for a couple of days and do that. And I can, it drives her a bit crazy, but I just sort of think it's part of that thing of, I think it's right not to make big decisions or small decisions that can become big decisions without me sort of running it by her.
So there were conversations, aren't there, with Fiona and Neil Kinnock trying to talk you out of the job, and Tony and Cherie explaining why they thought you were the right person and wanted you so badly.
Yeah. In the same house, in different rooms. It was a very, very odd holiday, it has to be said. But that's the thing about Tony, is that he does have very, very, very attuned political instincts. And I think he just sensed that we were in France on holiday with the Kinnocks. He'd asked me to do the job. I'd said, I'll think about it. And I think he sensed that I'd be getting talked out of it, which I was. And so he just turned up, phoned up and said, listen, we're only about a four-hour drive away. We're going to pop over and see you. And they came and stayed, mother-in-law, kids. There's a little restaurant in the village where we were staying. We went there a lot. We went down there one night and there were a few Brits in there. And so, they saw Neil Kinnock and they saw Tony Blair. And there was a bit of a buzz going around, right? So the woman who ran the restaurant, she came over and she said, what's the excitement all about? I said, it was quite difficult to explain, but it's like if you were in a restaurant in England and it's like Mitterrand and Jacques Delors have just arrived. And then Chinese whispers, the word went around the village that Mitterrand and Delors were at the restaurant. So all these people were coming out to see François Mitterrand and Jacques Delors to be very disappointed.
It's a wonder who on earth everybody was talking about. Yeah. As a young baby sort of reporter, I was on the Blair campaign trail, you know, well, you'll remember, but for our listeners, reporters sort of embed, don't they, and follow the potential leaders around the country, which I did with Tony Blair. And it was a sort of big moment in my young journalism career to stand in Downing Street in the media pack with him doing that speech. Where were you that day when Tony was at the microphone outside number 10?
As he was speaking, I was about 10 yards to his left and to your right. And actually, if you look at the pictures of that, I've got one on the wall over there of, because just to his right, the first children you see, there's Charlie Faulkner's kids, and then there's my three with Fiona, with Grace holding Fiona's hand. And it was a strange day in lots of ways. I can remember actually thinking amidst all this euphoria of feeling just a bit, you know, really tired. I was really tired. And I kept thinking, I've got to get some more energy from somewhere.
Do you think it was just exhaustion from the trail?
I think it was exhaustion combined with the fact that I knew I had to kind of go again, as it were. You all know this from covering something like a campaign. You set your mind for the campaign. I think particularly if you're in opposition, as we were, I didn't allow myself to think beyond the election, because I felt the moment I did that, I'd be almost conceding that I thought we'd won, which I don't think you can do in a campaign. You always have to think that you can lose. And Jonathan Powell, Tony's chief of staff, he was off doing the kind of preparing for government stuff. And I was really pleased about that. Even Jonathan was out with us on the campaign a bit, but his main focus was actually on the assumption that we won, getting ready. And I just wanted to focus every single day on the campaign. And including, you know, the day itself, the day of the election itself, I woke up thinking, right, what can we do today that could make us lose this? And that's just the mindset that I have.
I think that's the mindset of an athlete, Alistair, because I've interviewed a lot of people like James Cracknell, and you know, they talk about the feeling of elation when they win Olympic gold and they're on the podium, and then a real crash afterwards because everything's gone into that moment and there's all that glory and sense of achievement. But actually for you, once you got him into number 10, the real hard work began. We're talking more than a decade, aren't we, of really intense pressure, issues like Iraq, David Kelly's death, all the big stories that you had to deal with that are documented so well in your 8 volumes of memoirs. How did you cope with that kind of pressure for so, so long?
Well, sometimes I don't know. I think partly, it's interesting you talk about the mindset of an athlete. I mean, I've always been obsessed with sport. And actually, I wrote a book called Winners, which was about winners in business, politics and sport. And I concluded that the ones that most impressed me in the main were the sports people. And one of the things I asked them all was what motivated them more, loving winning or hating losing. And I think for a lot of them, it was hating losing. Even when we got in, I think Tony was very much the sort of very positive, very upbeat and what have you. And I think and maybe this speaks to the kind of depressive side of my character, but I think I was a lot of the time thinking about what could go wrong, not wanting it to go wrong, wanting to stop things going wrong. Look, I think the other thing to say is that this sounds a bit weird, really, but I didn't do anything else. So a lot of people say, well, how did you find time to keep a diary? Well, I say, well, I didn't go to the pub. I didn't go out much. You know, the only sort of little luxury I allowed myself in terms of outside stuff, you know, obviously any spare time I had was for the children in particular. They were so young at the time. And football, that was it. We tried to have holidays, but I don't think I had a single uninterrupted holiday. You know, that's the other thing. This is what I mean about what Fiona worries about. That is my personality. I can remember at one point she went to see Tony and said, look, I'm really worried. He just doesn't stop. He's home at the weekend, doesn't stop working. You've got to talk to him. He says, I do talk to him. And I say to him, you've got to, you know, but he says, that is his personality. You know that. It's true. When I get into something like that, I find it very hard to unplug. And, you know, you talked about the sports people who crash after they've won something, or after they've got to the end of a tournament or a football or at the end of the Premier League or whatever it might be. I find that on holidays. When I get on holiday, I crash. And I feel really bad about it because this is meant to be a time when you're enjoying yourself with your kids and what have you. But the first few days of a holiday, I'm a nightmare.
I find exactly the same thing. I think it's because, you know, I'm freelance and we juggle a lot of balls, don't we, in our career and family and all that kind of thing. And there's always, being freelance, there's always something to do. I never just sit down and relax very often. I'm trying to train myself to do that a bit better. And thinking of that, what did it feel like at the end when the job ended and suddenly that massive chunk of your life disappeared? I think you talk in the book about David Blunkett coming for dinner and you overhearing a chat with your daughter Grace about you sort of sitting on the sofa. Must have been such a contrast, number 10 to home. And how did that feel? Did you miss it?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, what Craig said was, she said to David that, no, it's quite nice having Dad home. I go to work in the morning, he's sitting where you are, and I come back in the afternoon, he's lying there fast asleep. No, I went through a massive depression, and I think it started as a literal decompression. You know, the pressure. It was a weird time because we had the whole Iraq thing going on. I'd been trying to get out for all sorts of reasons. Then we had David Kelly's death and then the Hutton inquiry. And then I finally got out during the Hutton inquiry. And so for days and weeks, we got media outside the house and your every move is being kind of analyzed and all this sort of stuff. And then after a couple of days, it's like, you know, there's nobody outside anymore. I missed that sense of full on intensity, but at the same time, I then ended up being trapped really in a sort of, I felt like a no man's land because I'd left, but I hadn't left. Certainly in Tony's mind, I hadn't really left. And a lot of the people in the company's mind, I hadn't left. And then when Gordon took over, in his mind, I hadn't left. And so I felt sort of trapped. And I did my best in terms of trying to help them, but I don't think I was as effective as I had been just because I just wasn't in a good state mentally.
Can we talk about your mental health? Because you are passionate about getting it talked about more. I don't mean your personal mental health, but mental health in general. And I have read your book. I found it really moving, Alistair, when you described what happens to you. And for those of us who have been lucky enough not to experience depression, can you give us a little bit of a sense of what happens? Because it feels like something really takes over.
It does take over. And it's never always the same. And what I tried to do in the book was kind of give a sense of a, and maybe I was taking different memories of different episodes. And I actually wrote a novel about mental illness. And in a funny sort of way, I think that describes it better than this book, because to know you give yourself a bit of free rein. And but in general terms, I'm usually conscious of it coming on. Not always. Sometimes it's instant, but I'm usually conscious of it coming on and there being a build-up. Often happens just after I wake up. And it's like a sort of physical, it's got physical presence. It's around. And I say in the book that it's sometimes like it's a cloud, but it's shaped a bit like a rugby ball. And it's got a texture, it's got a smell, it's got a taste. And I, you know, in the old days, before I just recognized that I have depression, I used to torture and I say, you know, leave me alone, you're not coming near me and what have you. But now I'm much more like, oh, God, here we go again. And I say, come on then, get it over with. And sometimes it feels like you're always being injected with something and you can feel that your physical state is changing. You suddenly feel heavy and you feel, and then the irony is you also feel empty at the same time and your mind is just a fuzz. And things that normally you want to do, like get out of bed, like enjoy yourself, like work, like write, like go for a run, whatever, all the things that you would normally feel you want to do, you just don't want to do them. And it's a real struggle to kind of to do things. If it's really bad, it can then take you into kind of sort of suicidal ideation and you start lying there thinking, oh, I think I'd be better off dead. And I think Fiona would be happy if I was dead and the kids' lives would be easier if I was dead. And before you know it, you're kind of writing your obituaries and planning your funeral. And so that's what it's like for me. And I can't describe other people's depressions, but that's what mine feels like.
And that can last a few days, can't it, Alistair, which I would imagine must also feel awful when it starts to come on, because you know that even though you've learned various techniques to try and lift yourself out of it, you know you're in for a good horrible few days, really, I suppose.
Well, it can be shorter and it can be longer, and that is a really unpleasant part of it, is like, because when it first comes on, it feels like the first time all over again in a way. Or put it this way, you don't relate it to what's happened before. And there comes a point where you can say to yourself, I've got through worse than this. I've seen this off before. But you're absolutely right. There are moments where you think, you know, this time it's got me forever. This time there's no getting out of it. It's going to be like, this is my life now forever. And that is a horrible, horrible, horrible feeling. I've just actually been reading a book. One of the things I've been doing in lockdown is brushing up my German, which I did to degree level and then forgot a lot about it. So I've just been reading a lot of German books, and one of them I've been reading is a German goalkeeper called Robert Enke, who killed himself while he was still a top player. He was an international goalkeeper. The book's been written by his best friend, and his wife's cooperated and what have you, but it's really interesting because I just get such a sense of when he's in the depressive moods, and I just get such a sense of totally relating both to him and to the people around him who are trying to help him with it. And that sense, and of course, he in the end, he killed himself. And, you know, as you know, I talk about my depression scale, 1 to 10, and 10 is suicide. And I never let myself go beyond 9 or 2, because those two ends of the scale for me are just too scary to think about, really. So I've deliberately put them in a kind of no-go zone. But he went there. And there's a heartbreaking bit in this book where his wife, Teresa, says to him, look, this is after one of his really bad depressive episodes where he's disappeared and then he comes back and he's in a terrible state. And she says, just promise me you will never, ever kill yourself. And he said, yeah, I promise. And of course, you know, eventually he did. And so people do, you know, and I get that suicidal ideation thing. And I write in the book about my cousin who did kill himself. And one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was because his children, who I'm very close to, are now all grown up, you know, including with kids of their own. I know they still feel it really, really deeply. And it was 21 years ago now. And they still feel it really, really deeply. And it's a very human thing to think you could have stopped it. And it's a very human thing to think it must have been something about me. But actually, what I try to say to them is, if it's anything like me when I get suicidal ideation, Lachie, my cousin, will have been thinking, oh, this is best for them. It's best for them if I get rid of myself now. I'm convinced of that.
That's lovely that you've sort of written it for them in mind. What made me a bit sad about your 1 to 10 scale, you said that you've rarely felt a 10, but it also made me a bit sad that you never wake up as a 1, which is the really happy end.
No, that slightly misunderstands it. I do wake up at 2.
Yeah.
2, by the way, is a bit wearing for other people. 2 is when I wake up and I decide that Fiona needs me to sing to her before she's even got out of bed, and I just behave like a bit of an idiot. And I do this thing where I can sing to the tune of Flower of Scotland, or she, Charles Aznavour, either of them, I can sing to those two tunes absolutely anything at any time. I can make it work. It's just a thing I do. But 1, to me, is a dangerous level of happiness. You basically become unhinged from the world.
Yeah, so we don't want you as a number 1.
No, so 1's not good. 3 and 4 are where I want to be.
It's so important, isn't it, Alistair, that we talk about all this, we talk about our feelings, and that people don't feel stigmatised. And I still think we've got a long way to go. I think Prince Harry's done a lot for making people feel able that they can talk about it, but there is an awful long way to go, isn't there?
Definitely. There's no doubt on the destigmatisation and the talking about it. We're in a far better place. And I do think William and Harry and Kate with the Heads Together campaign have done an amazing job, you know, in their various roles now. I hope they continue with that. But I still get letters and emails from people who, particularly in the workplace or in the family, say they just feel they cannot raise it with anybody because the stigma's there. And they, you know, I talked to a nurse, said that she is convinced, I hope she's wrong, but she tells me she knows the people she works for, she is convinced that if she told them the truth, which is that she's on medication for her bipolar disorder, that would be held against her and she'd never get promoted. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what she thinks. And she thinks that because the stigma's still there.
What are the coping mechanisms that you've learnt over the years? And do tell us a bit about your chapter on the life-saving jam jar.
My jam jar? That's my jam jar. I have my jam jar with me. And it's funny, isn't it, how you get sort of little things you pick up along the way in life. The book's really in two parts. First half is me, my life, my mental health, my family's mental health, that kind of whole story. And then the second half, they call it a search for a cure, but it's really just looking at different ways that people are looking at this. I wanted to check out the whole thing about whether it's genetic. And so I went to see a woman in Canada called Janine Austin, who's a genetics expert, really nice woman. And during the course of the conversation, she said, yeah, well, she gets depression as well. And so we were talking about how we deal with our depression. And she said, well, look, I use a jam jar. Down at the bottom of the jam jar is a sediment, and that's your genes. And then the rest of the jam jar is your life, and your life fills up with good and bad, and it mixes up. And most of the time, we can cope with what's going on inside the jam jar. But when the jam jar gets too full, it explodes, and the lid explodes off, and we get ill. And that's how we get ill, because we can't cope with what's going on in our life. And she said, most of the time, we try and, the Freudians are down here in the bottom, you know, saying, did you ever have very strange sexual thoughts about your mother? And then this lot up in the life bit is the sort of life coaches and the therapists and the, you know, and they're saying, what did you do last Wednesday morning? And what did that make you think and feel, and et cetera? And she said, that's all fine. We can do that. But what we really need to think is, how do we grow the jam jar so as we can put more of our life into it? And in the book, as you'll have seen, I've got a kind of draw your own jam jar at the end. But so my jam jar starts with what I call FFF, Fiona, family, friends. Relationships are the most important thing. Then it's work, meaningful activity. And for me, that means work to make a living, but just as important, probably more important, it means still staying involved and trying to change the world and, you know, do things that matter and what have you. And then it's the fundamentals, sleep, diet, exercise, which I never, as you described, I never used to take seriously. I used to see sleep as a sign of weakness, a waste of time. Why would anybody want to sleep when they could be doing things? Sleep's just something you have to do, but do it as little as you possibly can. That's what I thought.
It's a great healer, isn't it, sleep?
Yeah, for sure. And then exercise, I was in the Lido at 7 this morning. I exercise every single day. And then it's the things that are very personal to you. So for me, it's my bagpipes, it's my Burnley Football Club, it's the musicians that I love, it's the writers that I love, it's the dog, it's beautiful scenery. These are all things that are there. They're my things, and your things will be different, and everybody else's things will be different. And then I've got my thematic stuff, which for me, the two most important are curiosity and creativity. So I have to write something every day, and I have this little motto, never go to bed without knowing something you didn't know when you woke up. And that's just about trying to stay curious. And then what's interesting about that is it's only when I'm up here on my jam jar when I say medication and my psychiatrist. So even something like the swimming, you know, the swimming for me in lockdown has just been, because we can't travel, can't go anywhere. That's, I found that really, really difficult. But when the Lido's been open, I've been every single day, no matter how cold it is, I've been in there. I do 2 minutes per degree plus 2 minutes. That's my little thing. I feel better.
Do you know, I think all of our mental health's been tested, hasn't it, during the pandemic? And I think one of the positives we can take away from it is the exercise front. Everybody I've spoken to has got lots more active, whether that just be going to the park or swimming or getting out. I think that's helped a lot of people through.
Yeah. Although I think there are people who actually have found the whole thing so difficult that it's made that I've been in touch with, or, you know, met or talked to people who actually say they found it so much harder to go out there. You know, I think maybe a little less so now with the whole vaccination thing, but I think at a certain point, a lot of people were literally scared of other people, scared of contact. You know, that's dangerous.
It's not a great place to be in, isn't it? No. Now, one thing I did enjoy during lockdown is your bagpipe playing for the NHS. But do you know what, Alistair? I couldn't find any sound on any of those clips on YouTube because I wanted to play a clip in. So I have found you. I don't know. I hope people haven't taken it off. But we've got a little clip of you, which I will play in. About your love of the bagpipes, and does that come from Dad?
Yeah, I mean, my dad taught me, and I think it comes from several places. We were born in, me and my two brothers and my sister were all born in Yorkshire, brought up in Yorkshire, but both our parents very Scottish. My dad from the Hebrides, my mum from Ayrshire, and I always felt Scottish. I've always felt British and Scottish. I've never seen myself as English. And my brother, who I write about in the book a lot, because he had schizophrenia and he died a few years ago now, but he was essentially a professional piper. I mean, piping was his life. And since my dad and my brother have died, pipers have become much more important to me. So I learned as a child. I played in lots of pipe bands. I competed. But then as I went into, you know, a different sort of life, I just kind of let it go. But in recent years, it actually, funny enough, it was a TV program that really kind of resurrected it for me. I don't know if you've seen the program on Sky Arts called First Love.
Yes, I have.
And it's about where you play, you go back and learn a musical instrument. And I ended up playing, I got this fantastic teacher, Finlay MacDonald, he's become a really good friend. And I ended up playing in this St. Andrew's Day concert, the Royal Concert Hall in Glasgow, after a few months. And it just resurrected my kind of passion for it. When my dad died, my brother died, Donald, my brother, he was a bit of a hoarder. But when he died, we were clearing his flat out. We found, oh my God, so many old sets of bagpipes, so many practice chanters, so many reeds and everything. And he'd left his best pipes to me. And they're the ones that I play now. And the rest, we gave them to schools and we gave them to piping colleges and what have you. But so yeah, so like even sitting here now, I've got my practice chanter there with me the whole time, and I regularly, when I'm just sort of sitting here writing or whatever, and I pick it up, I'll just fiddle away. And
oh, go on, spoil me with a little bit. That was lovely.
Okay, this is the thing you learn on, right? This is not,
yeah.
So you
not play. Yeah, not full on bagpipes, but
no,
the sort of training.
Not full on bagpipes. What shall I play? How's that?
That's so cool. I really wasn't expecting a bit of that on our podcast.
That's called Highland,
how great was
that's
that?
Called Highland Cathedral if you need any copyright addressing issues.
Oh, thank you very much. Now, apart from the bagpipes, which you're passionate about Burnley, aren't you? Burnley FC. And again, does that stem from being young?
Yeah, you know, we grew up in Yorkshire. Burnley's a Lancashire team, but they were, you know, 20 miles away from where we lived. And I guess I am a bit of an obsessive personality, and I fell in love with them, and I've been in love with them ever since. And, you know, at the moment, we're doing really, really well. We've been in the Premier League for the last few years. I'm incredibly lucky and sort of privileged because, of course, having become sort of well-known and well-known as a Burnley fan, I kind of, I'd say two of our managers have become, you know, quite close, really quite close friends. And another close, really close friend is a guy who used to play for us in the 70s when I was a teenager, traipsing around the country and getting his autograph. He's called Paul Fletcher. We've written a novel together about football in the 70s, and he calls himself Celebrity Taxis because he picks me up at Preston Station and drives me to games now. But and I think the other thing, going back to Fiona, I do think one of the things that has made our relationship sort of work and endure is we do have our own things, you know, like Fiona's, swimming used to be Fiona's thing, is now my thing as well, but you know, she's much more interested in probably classical music and opera than I am. But she's always understood this football thing from my perspective. She doesn't understand it at all. Like the other day, even though I can't go to the games at the moment, I go to some because I do the commentary. But the other day we were playing, it was on telly. We do this thing on a Sunday where we go and collect food from the supermarkets and take them to this food bank, Life After Hummus. We do it every Sunday morning, but I was in a panic because we had a 12 o'clock kickoff. And she couldn't understand that. Had to be back for 11:30 at the latest. She just can't understand that. And, you know, but it's like, she says, it's not going to start before 12. So, no, you don't understand. I've got to be there. I've got the pre-match interviews. I've got to feel I'm part of it. I want to know what's going on. So she's quite good at understanding, but she doesn't really understand it.
You mentioned the Premier League there. I mean, it does seem quite incredible, doesn't it, Alistair, that, you know, the Premier League's dominated by the super clubs with multi-million pound players, managers, mega stadiums, and there's little Burnley with its 20,000-seater stadium. It's quite special, isn't it?
Yeah, but I have a fair idea what our manager and our players earn, and I think it's fair to say they're probably the best paid people in Burnley and surrounding area. Yeah, but I like that about it. That's one of the things I love about it. You know, I followed Burnley from the very, very top. We were reigning league champions when I first saw Burnley in 1961. And then 26 years later, we had to win a game against Leighton Orient to stay in the fourth division. Otherwise, we'd have been out of the Football League. And now we've worked our way back up. And I'd much rather that than be a kind of Manchester City or Chelsea supporter where you think you've got a sort of divine right to win games and win trophies. And they haven't got a clue what it's like following a football team. I've been to 87 away grounds as a Burnley fan.
Wow. And is it true that you were known as a pie eater at one point? Didn't Holland's Meat Pies sponsor the team and the supporters were known as pie eaters? I think that's great.
I've never got the football pie thing, really. Because they're so messy to eat. It's like, you know, you don't want gravy running on your fingers.
No, I'm a Grimsby lass and I go to Grimsby every Boxing Day. If they play at home on Boxing Day, and of course Grimsby Town are the only football team in the land that never play at home because the ground's actually in Cleethorpes. So that's a good little trivia question there. But it's brilliant. And
There's a few of those at the moment.
Are there?
Yeah, I think, where do Coventry play at the moment? They play in Birmingham.
Do they? And is Prince Charles a Burnley fan?
Well, he says he is. He's not actually been to a game yet.
Right.
But because he does he's been to the ground, and the Queen's been to the ground as well.
Gosh.
I'll have you know. She opened the University College of Football Business, which started at Burnley. And Prince Charles does a lot in that area with the Weaver's Triangle. It's called the Weaver's Triangle. And he does a hell of a lot of stuff up there with the Prince's Trust. And so there is quite a good picture of Charles holding his Burnley shirt with HRH1 on it. Look, he identifies as a Burnley fan, put it
that
way.
That's good enough for you. Now, what I want to talk about towards the end of our lovely chat is your podcast with your daughter, Grace.
Well, it's called Football, Feminism and Everything in Between, because I'm an absolute football fanatic and she's a feminist fanatic.
Well, Grace, I've actually got you another really, really, really good guest for the podcast, who I bumped into doing Steph's Packed Lunch up in Leeds.
I've actually already been on this person's podcast. I know him just as well as you do. Thank you very much.
Why didn't you think to ask him to come on our podcast? Because he's obviously a very interesting guest.
It was me who asked him.
No, Grace. I asked him and he said yes. And
he's very funny, isn't he?
He's very, 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 very funny. But he's also really smart when he's being serious.
When the whole podcast thing started, she nagged me, you should do a podcast, you'd be really good, you should do a podcast, da, 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 da. And I just couldn't be bothered, I was doing enough stuff. So eventually she sort of persuaded me we should do one together. I mean, it's just really us talking, and then we usually have one big guest on and talk to them. Good fun, I enjoy it.
It must be really nice working on a project together. I mean, she's a comedian, isn't she, Grace? And I know that she wrote a show for the Edinburgh Fringe called Why I'm Never Going Into Politics. Did you do a fantastic job of putting her off?
She is quite political, though. In her own way. Of our three children, Grace is the one who is, how can I put this, most willing to exploit her background and most out there about using it to her own ends, put it that way. So yeah, it didn't surprise me at all that her first big comedy gig was Why I Will Never Go Into Politics, because she knew, and she was right, that she'd get more publicity by making it about that. But she is very funny, and some of the stuff she does is absolutely brilliant. You know, I think it's hard. I'm not sure I'd want to be in my 20s or 30s at the moment. I think going it alone on anything is hard, and comedy's hard. Listen, my kids, they're all doing very, very different things, but I think they've all done pretty well considering, yeah, I guess it was quite a strange childhood in a way.
Yeah, certainly different, I suppose, wasn't it? Given how probably absorbed you had to be with the politics side of things. But the other thing I've enjoyed flicking through is your Twitter account. And what did make me laugh, because you talk a lot about Boris Johnson and a lot about your tree of the day. And sometimes, as I noticed the other day with a rather wild looking tree with crazy branches all over, they're interchangeable, aren't they?
Do you think I talk about Boris Johnson too much?
I don't know. You talk about him a lot. But then, you know, with your background, I can understand why you talk about him a lot.
Yeah, and he's Prime Minister. I think he's doing a terrible job, and I think a lot of people are not seeing it in the same way, and I guess I'm trying to persuade people, but yeah, I try and dial it down some days. But the tree of the day thing, it goes back to my jam jar. It's like, I've always liked really nice scenery, and the tree thing just sort of taking on a life of its own. It's really weird. I was talking to a guy today, he's got his own strategy company, and he enters quite regularly. He sends in pictures of trees, and he won my gold medal one day, which, by the way, aren't real. And he said that his cleaner phoned him up and said, oh, you've won tree of the day. Like, it was a big thing. It's like, and some days I get them sent from sort of all over the world, but at least five times a week, I'm the winner. I take the picture of the winner.
Really? Well, I'm gonna have a go at winning the gold medal, because I've been in London parks, royal parks, very, very early in the morning, most days on lockdown. Oh,
I think the best park for trees, the best of the royal parks for trees, I'd say is Hyde Park.
My favourite's Richmond Park.
Yeah, Richmond Park's, yeah, okay. I was thinking of sort of central London. But, you know, you're hard-pressed to beat Hampstead Heath, I've got to say.
Yeah, that's true. I'm nearer Richmond, but there've been some glorious sunrises in the morning. So I might send you one on Twitter. And also, what are you up to with Portrait Artist of the Year? Because I've been looking at that on your feed too.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. It was good fun.
Did you?
Have you ever seen it?
Yeah, I have seen it.
They're always looking for people, Helen. So
if you'd
like to sit. It's quite an interesting experience. So basically, you get three different artists. They enter by doing a self-portrait, and then they get selected. And they have three artists. You have a discussion about how they want you to sit, and you talk a little bit, but not too much. It's a very, very, very high quality production. I counted 16 cameras in the room, including one that is recording every single thing that they do on the canvas. So they all do their own portrait. And then at the end, you have to pick one, which you get to take home. And I found that really hard. I actually said that it's like when people say, who's your favourite child? And you're not going there, you know?
So what have you done with yours?
Well, I haven't got it yet because they're still finishing the post edit and all that. But I don't know, because it's my eighth. No, I've now had 10. Without three, I've had 10. And I've only got two in the house, and they're both behind that sofa, hidden. I think there's something really vain about putting your own portraits up in your own house.
Yeah, there is really, isn't there? And what are you up to next? What exciting things have you got on the horizon now that we're coming out of lockdown and some kind of normal life will start to resume?
Well, I don't know, to be honest. I mean, I've got the Living Better book, as you say, the paperback's coming out, so I've got a bit of stuff to do with that. But I'm back to the whole kind of the round of speaking consultancy. I've got one of my favourite people I work with, Edi Rama, the Prime Minister of Albania. He's in the middle of an election campaign. First time I've actually not been able to go out and physically help him, as it were. But so he's hopefully going to get he'll be my, it's a very short list of Labour leaders that I've helped to win three general elections. Because he's on his third and it's looking pretty good at the moment. And then, to be honest, I really am looking forward to getting away to France. You know, we've got a place out there and we've not been there for a year, and I'm a bit sort of desperate to get there.
Oh, we need some sunshine, don't we? Alistair, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat to you today. You're always so generous with your time, and I know we could speak for hours and hours and hours, but covered lots of subjects. Yeah, fascinating.
Brilliant. It's lovely to see you again.
Well, you've been listening to Alistair Campbell, reflecting on his time at number 10, working with Tony Blair, life in the public eye, his openness about his battle with depression and the need to get it talked about, his love of Burnley FC and passion for the bagpipes. And check out his podcast with daughter Grace. Download and subscribe to our series at convex.podbean.com or search The Convex Conversation on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, or simply ask Alexa. I'll be back next week with another great guest. Bye for now.